Before we begin, we ask that if you have a cell phone, that you please turn it off completely, as digital interaction is very distracting to others. Thank you. My name is Sue, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Vegan Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Really quickly, before we get started, Guy has an announcement.
November, all jobs change. So now's the time to volunteer. I'm going to hand round a little board, one for each block, and a pen. Please fill in volunteer jobs. We function if we have people helping us get the meeting going. We all stay sober if we help out. There'll be a board and a pen. You'll see on the form what you need to fill in. I hope you will volunteer for lots of things. When they get to the front, please put them on the stage, and I hope the pen comes back.
Thank you, Guy. Emma will read the preamble.
Fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Emma. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Evan will read the steps.
Evan, alcoholic? One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to prove our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Evan. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by the information break, and then our main speaker will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Miriam.
First, I just want to say thanks for asking me to speak. and for letting me be of service, even though there are a lot of people in this room. And yeah, I will just try and use the time the best that I can. My sobriety date is June 10th, 2010. So I had an anniversary this summer, and I'm grateful to be sober. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor women, and some of my sponsees also have sponsees, so I believe in sponsorship. While I've been sober, things have usually gone a lot better when I've had a sponsor and when I've had strong sponsorship, so I'll just say again that I believe in sponsorship. So I got sober in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I grew up in that town. That's a town that seems bigger than it actually is because there's a university, but if you're a townie there, it's just pretty much growing up in a small Midwestern town where everyone knows everyone, and everyone knows everyone's business. My mom was a drug and alcohol counselor who didn't drink because she got depressed when she drank. So I don't know if she's a problem drinker. My dad was an alcoholic, but he passed away when I was really young, so I didn't grow up seeing alcohol in the house, but I do believe that for me, just based off my family background, that you know, alcoholism is a hereditary disease, though just because you have parents that are alcoholics doesn't mean you're going to be an alcoholic, but that was certainly what happened with me. Before I ever picked up a drink, I definitely showed signs of alcoholism, a lot of fear as a very fearful child, and I always felt like I was a little different than everyone else. One example of self-centered fear from when I was little that I always talk about is people are always asking little kids what superhero power they would have if they were little, and like other kids, like I remember they would always say normal things like I wish I could fly or I wish I could breathe underwater or something cute like that, but I would always say that I wish that I could be invisible so I could tell if people were talking about me. So that's like a bad sign. The first time that I ever picked up a drink, the first time I ever got drunk, I was probably 12. I didn't have a lot of access to alcohol then, so I didn't start drinking regularly then, but I remember the way it felt. I remember it felt awesome to me, and I felt like I was a part of, and I remember lying about it too, and just kind of the... you know, the stupid, like, audacity of, like, you know, the whole thing, like, just, like, being a drunk 12-year-old in front of my mom and, like, lying to her, like, what are you talking about? And that kind of attitude would follow me through my using. In high school, you know, there was a quick shift between, you know, having a lot of activities, having a lot of friends that were, like, good friends to chasing things that felt more exciting to me, which was just anything that could get me out of myself. I didn't have a lot of consequences then. Those would come in my later teens and in my early 20s. You know, some of those consequences were internal. Isolation, having a relationship to substances that was, you know, I knew at the time was just to change how I felt, so not like a normal, happy relationship, like definitely a relationship built on need and dependency and being, you know, accepting that and being fine with that. And, you know, then later, more serious consequences. I had already lost relationships, I had already kind of lost important parts of myself, but I started having legal consequences in my late teens and in my early 20s, and also life happened too, and I wasn't able to show up for it. I had a mother that, you know, had a series of serious health problems, and I was not able to show up for her, and thank God she's healthy today, and if something happened, I could, but at the time, I couldn't, and so, you know, there were a number of times where that actually endangered her. Which, you know, only child, single parent thing, that was, like, definitely a loss of spiritual values. So you know, I had been living that way probably, I would say for a good solid 10 years, I had been living in a way where, whether it was through alcohol, other substances, or just like other maladaptive behavior, I was trying to get outside myself. And, you know, I didn't stop that because of one big consequence. I feel like a lot of things came together for me, including consequences I had over and over again. You know, something clicked. And for me, I think that was an intervention from my higher power. I found myself in a waiting room. My mom was sick. She should have been, like, in the hospital earlier, but I couldn't show up for her. I was feeling, like, really horrible about myself. And, you know, just had a moment of clarity. And I remember looking on the television, and there was a woman that, actually a teenager that had died from a drug overdose. And I had already been court-ordered to meetings, so I was already kind of exposed to the program, and it was already ruining my relationship with, my already horrible relationship with drugs and alcohol. And so in that moment, something changed for me. And what changed for me is that I was ready to start working the steps, and I was ready to stop disappearing and not calling my sponsor when I picked up. And, you know, I actually never picked up again, but just the willingness to try, because before I was really afraid to try because I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to. So that's what changed, and that was my sobriety date. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but something I found out later is that also happened to be the same day that my dad had died. So I really do feel that, you know, God had a hand in me getting sober. You know, and I know people have a lot of different feelings about that, but, you know, it's definitely not within my own doing alone. So for me, working the steps helped me, helped relieve me of the obsession to drink and use drugs, first and foremost. I don't have that today, which is incredible because I used to not be able to, like, even, I used to not be able to even, like, brush my teeth without some kind of substance in my body. Like, I couldn't even get out of bed. And, you know, I'm, like, constantly doing things all the time that feel like they're, like, way too much for me. So, you know, like, that's an amazing gift today. You know, and I'm just kind of joking about that too, because, like, I do get overwhelmed by stuff today, but the fact that I've been able to stay sober, you know, and that I've been able to, like, with the help of this program and with the steps and with my higher power, have, like, a psychic shift, like, you know, even when I'm, like, really, like, in it and I'm having, like, a hard time, I know that, like, today I have, like, hope that there's, like, another part, that there's, like, something better on the other side rather than, like, another shoe's gonna drop or, like, living in, like, constant fear. So I'd say the steps today also help me with my sanity. And I know that because I know that when I'm not actively working the steps or helping bring a sponsee through the steps, I get more insane. You know, and for me, like, what my insanity looks like are, you know, selfish self-centeredness, you know, wishing I was invisible so I could see if people were talking about me, like, that kind of stuff, you know, that was there before this program. And, you know, in the 7 years I've been sober, like, I've had periods where I'm not ruled by that, and I've also had periods where, like, you know, it comes back in and it takes a lot of work and a lot of vigilance to, like, not live that way. But, like, I know there's a choice today, and that, like, with hard work and, like, staying connected, that I can feel free, even if it's, like, you know, something that I have to work at, and I'm just really grateful.
Thank you, Miriam. Our Our second 10-minute speaker is Jay.
Well, I thought this would be an empty hall right now. When Ali asked me to speak, it's been almost a year. I'm surprised it took him this long to ask. That's not a huge ego. And the second thought was like, oh crap, the Patriots are playing. Oh crap, the Red Sox are playing. I grew up in New England, so I'm a diehard sports fan. And but when it comes down to it, like, this is where I need to be. The game's still going to happen. My alcoholism doesn't sleep. So I'm glad to be here. It really is a great honor to be asked to share. So my name is Jay Sezlik, and I'm an alcoholic. And it was really good to hear you, Barry. Like, there's a couple of things that really stood out to me. One was that I also grew up in a college town and spent a lot of time at that college during the school year. And then when the summer happened, a lot of them would leave, and then we'd have the whole town to ourselves and did a lot of damage there. There's another thing that I'm kind of going about. I am definitely an alcoholic. This meeting has been extremely helpful to me. I come here usually on a regular basis. Some things that I do now to stay sober. I have a sponsor. I sponsor guys. Our sponsor knows that I'm a sponsee. I touch base with them on a weekly basis. And I let them know where I'm at. And I actively work the steps. And, like, you know, there's a lot of great information in this book. But me knowing this information isn't going to keep me sober, right? Like, I have to put it into application in my life. And I feel like that's a theme that continues to kind of smack me in the face over and over again. But just to kind of give you a glimpse of why I'm even willing to do the stuff that I do, alcohol, I love alcohol, right? I mean, I love the effect that alcohol has given me. But as time went on, it really did not, it didn't work out so well. And it didn't start out that way. I didn't start out, detoxing on a couch the first time I drank. I didn't start out, compromising my morals and participating in illegal activity. That's not a requirement for being an alcoholic, but that's where my alcoholism took me. Because I really, really wanted relief, and then the effect that alcohol was producing got less and less as time went on. But growing up in a college town, I mean, what we would do is, probably starting around middle school, we would play Hey Mister, which is basically you just go in front of the package store and you ask random strangers and you say, "Hey Mister, will you buy me a six pack?" And that's what we did. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And if it didn't work, then we would get other stuff to use. And that's kind of how my weekends went for a little while. And more I realized how much I never really saw my childhood as like a bad childhood, right? I never thought myself as uncomfortable. It was just what I did, right? But when I found alcohol, everything just was better. And I wanted that as often as possible. And I just assumed that everyone had that same feeling. I just assumed that everyone felt that way about alcohol, but they had just more of a discipline to stay away from it. So as time went on, the more and more I enjoyed being under the influence, the more I enjoyed kind of escaping from sobriety, the less I was able to really be sober, and the less I was able to sit in my own skin. So as time went on, it got to the point where I was really, for me, my experience is that I was in a round the clock using something. Whether if it wasn't drinking, it was something else. I was constantly playing chemist. I was always trying to just feel okay, right? And like playing chemist to try to just feel normal. And towards the end, I was doing so many ridiculous things just to try to feel normal. And that window of time to feel normal got less and less. It's like I would hustle every single day for 50, if I got 15 minutes of feeling normal, that was like, I would settle for that, right? To the point where like even that wasn't working. So I got to a place where I realized that I couldn't live this life anymore. Alcohol didn't have the same effect that it did before. And I'd been introduced to AA before. I'd gotten a DUI a couple of years prior, and I'd gone to a meeting, and I always knew that I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know that I was the type of alcoholic that needed to like go to meetings or do step work or do anything that like you people do. Like that was not for me. Like as long as I have a job to prop me up, as long as I have a relationship, like I just won't drink, I'll live my life, I'll be sober, I'll be happy, and I thought that would work for me. If that works for anyone in here, that is awesome. Go for it, right? That was not my experience. I learned the hard way. I'm really grateful for that experience. You know, it gave me the willingness to come back to AA. And when I got here, it really came down to just being willing to take the action. And I saw it working in other people's lives. You know, I saw this levity and peace that people had that were sober and didn't know those could coexist. And I was intrigued, and I wanted to know how exactly they got from point A to point B. So I would hear their stories, and I could relate to like where they were, because that's where I was in that moment in time. Right, so much pain, just crawling in my skin. And so I did the work. You know, I found a sponsor, I got involved in a home group, I got active in that home group, and all the things that you hear in these meetings, like I took action, right? And what I found, is that the more I take action, the more I'm able to recover. And it doesn't matter what I know, it's what I do. And I can equate that to like the relationship that I have with my higher power. It's like, it doesn't matter whether I think that God exists or it doesn't, right? It's what am I doing, right? Like what are my actions indicating, right? And usually if I'm taking a lot of action, I get a feeling that I'm taken care of, and I like to think of that as my relationship with God. Like, regardless of whatever life is throwing at me, like, I feel like I'm gonna be okay, right? I might not enjoy it, but I'm gonna be okay. And one thing that Miriam had mentioned that, you know, first and foremost is that, like, I rarely think about drinking or getting high today, which is strange because I used to have to do something to just get out of bed every single day, right? I had to get my levels up just to leave the house. And that's not my experience today. You know, and I've heard it described recently, to kind of go back to this idea with God, is like, I've heard it described as like, God doesn't necessarily exist in the sense that like I can touch it or I can see it, right? I can see it working in other people's lives, right? But that it actually calls everything into existence, right? That idea that God actually like illuminates everything in my world. And that's a pretty cool way to look at it, right? It's not like this tangible thing that I can touch. It's an experience. It's felt, right? And in the book, it talks about, you know, we agnostics, which is one of my favorite chapters in the big book, but like that my knowledge of God is intellectual, right? If it's intellectual, it's not going to keep me sober, right? That piece of knowledge isn't going to keep me sober. It's like on a spiritual level, it's felt, right? And if I feel connected to God, then I'll have the power to actually stay sober. Because my evidence shows that I'm powerless. You know, I knew that when I started drinking, I couldn't stop, right? And if I had two drinks, I was uncomfortable, right? But what I didn't realize and why I continue to show up at AA is that I have a mind that always brings me back to that idea that, like, this time will be different. I've gone, you know, from 8 o'clock to 4 p.m., I must be normal, right? Or I've gone from, like, September to November, I must be able to drink normal. Or I don't really care what the consequence is tomorrow, I really want that relief right now. And it's all just a lie that I tell, that my alcoholism tells me, to pick up a drink again, and I'm constantly doing that if I don't find a solution to that. And what I found today, when I didn't, you know, obviously I didn't make it up. It's what people have done before me, and it's what someone gave me freely, was this program, right? And then as long as I'm doing this program, I'm going to be able to go to bed sober today, and I'll be comfortable in my skin, and I don't have to worry about it, right? So I appreciate you guys' attention, and thank you for letting me come out here.
While the basket is being passed, please keep in mind that our rent is $600 per month. Please give what you can and see the treasurer's report on the board or our treasurer, Christina, after the meeting with any questions. Thanks in advance for your generosity. We have A literature available on the table at the back. If you don't have the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, please don't leave here tonight without one. It sells for $9.50. If you haven't bought one for a newcomer lately, I strongly encourage you to do so. We also have meeting directories available, and I don't have one up here, but they are free. It's a little book. Please visit our website, beacongroupaa.com, where you can sign up for membership in our group, join our email list, view announcements, listen to past speakers. If you have any questions, you can see me, Sarah, after the meeting. Sponsorship is a cornerstone of AA's 12-step recovery program. If you are a newcomer and you don't have a sponsor, we strongly suggest that you get one. Please see Jason, or Laura. She's right there, blonde. After the meeting, they will be stationed by the door. If you are looking to be a sponsor, talk to Jason or Laura as well. We have two ongoing monthly commitments. On the second Tuesday of the month, October 10th at 7 p.m., we will be going to the Women's Renewal at the Dimmick Center in Roxbury. Please see Sarah or Allie. Which Sarah? I don't know. But you can see me if you have any questions about that. I think Allie's here tonight, but maybe she's in the bathroom. Oh, right there. Mickey Mouse shirt. On the third Tuesday of the month, October 17th at 7 p.m., we will be going to Whitten Hospital in Everett. Please see Elizabeth or Tara. If you would like to go. Everyone is welcome on that commitment as well. Before I turn the meeting back over to our leader, please remember there's no smoking on church property. If you smoke or vape, we ask that you only do so on the public sidewalks away from the church entrances, either on Harvard or Marion Streets. There is a receptacle provided for bucks, and we appreciate smokers using this. Now I will turn the meeting back over to Sue. Thank you.
AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in much the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Brendan has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name should never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principle before personalities.
Thank you, Brendan. Tonight, our main speaker is Betsy. I'm sorry, it's Maria.
I would be okay if it was Betsy.
Maria, alcoholic.
Hi. Okay. I'll just say first how I'm up here tonight. Yesterday, I was informed that my almost two-year gig as the 30-minute backup female speaker was coming to an end. So, for almost 2 years, I've got to be the backup 30-minute speaker, but I was really saved at the last minute. But it's over. I'm here. it was a great job. You didn't have to do anything. So, I do get super nervous when I speak, and that's for two reasons, well, three, self-centered fear. And then I do take speaking extremely seriously because AA has given me my entire life. So I take it seriously for that reason, and because I take myself way too seriously. So it's a combination of factors. I almost always start out with my first drink because I've been doing that since the beginning of my sobriety. Because the first time I ever tried to speak at a meeting, it was on like 69th Street on the Upper West Side of New York at Chelsea Riverside, 9 p.m., also called Chock Full of Nuts, because that's the coffee we drank. So it's a Monday night meeting at 9 o'clock, so that's not right. You shouldn't be up at 9 on Monday going out, but that meeting was. So when I tried to speak at that meeting, I froze. I couldn't talk, I couldn't say my name. I mean, I probably only had a couple of months, I don't know. And they said, just start with your first drink. If you freeze, that will prime you. So my very first drink was when I was 14 years old. It was a glass of vodka. I had stolen the bottle of vodka. I had hid it for 3 months. I had lied to everyone in my family, and all my friends had lied to everyone in their family so that we could drink together. So right from the get-go, you know, I exhibited a lot of behaviors to get alcohol that I didn't exhibit in other areas of my life, and I'd also never had a drink before, so I don't even know how I knew how to do it, but I knew. And anyone who's heard my story has heard me say that when I was with my little friends standing in line at the store to buy juice, my friends were the same age, but they had more experience in things like boys and drugs and stuff. But they knew to go buy juice, but I was standing in the line thinking, can we skip the juice? Can we just get home? Why are we standing here buying this $2.99 bottle of grapefruit juice? It's 10 o'clock at night. You know, I'm not drinking the juice. So we get home, I have my very first drink of my life. It's a glass of vodka. It's gotta be more than 8 ounces. I'm 14. I weigh under 100 pounds. So my very first drink, blackout, on the ground in February. Some of my clothes not on, some of them on, crawling on the street in my hometown. And my mom finds me because she's driving my little brother home, and it's a small town. So my very first drink is in the shower, put there by my mom, put to bed, and then the next day I just got up and told my parents that my friends made me do it. Even though I had orchestrated every single thing to make that night happen. And they believe me. So, you know, we talk about what I was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I had, on many, many levels, and a great childhood. I had two parents who really loved me. I had a sibling that loved me. I grew up with every single thing you could physically want, and I was really loved. Now, my childhood wasn't perfect. I know now that I didn't ever drink. I didn't drink because of my childhood. I often drank over my childhood. I've often used my childhood as a reason. But it's not because of my childhood in any way, you know. I didn't suffer a hundred as much as people in this room have suffered when they were kids. You know, we had record players go out the window because there were record players back then. We had stuff happen. My dad was a super big time drinker. He was a writer. All his friends drank. That was their lifestyle. And my mom was married to him, and that was her full time job. You know, my dad had a very interesting life, you know, a lot of drinking, a lot of exciting times. My mom wasn't even aware of how many times he'd actually been married, nor how many children he actually had. That all came out later. That was just kind of par for the course. So that was that. So I guess what my point there was is I definitely remember feeling, you know, lonely and different and separate and isolated, even though I wasn't. I remember looking at all the houses in my neighborhood and thinking, oh, I wish we lived in a big house. I wish we lived in a pretty house. I wish I lived in one of those houses, like farther off in the East End. And when I go home now and I look at my neighborhood, I'm like, I did live in the East End. I did live in a big house. It was a pretty house. And I really, as a child, that's not where I was. I was like, everyone else is different, and I'm here in my own little universe. But the amazing thing is when I discovered booze, it set me free. All of a sudden, I was right on par with everyone else. We were all on the same team. Everyone was happy. This was amazing. Everything was going to be great, great, great. And that happened, you know, for a few minutes the first time I drank, and it happened. I mean, I loved drinking. And sometimes I forget to talk about just how great it was. Because I think I'm ashamed, like I don't want to like glamorize it or anything, but I obviously wouldn't be an A if I didn't really love booze. So in the beginning, what drinking did for me was everything. It fixed every cell in my body. It made me able to talk to boys, able to feel pretty, able to feel love, just like there was a future, like the future was green. It was going to be great. And I loved that feeling. So, you know, when I think about my alcoholism, which I do to a fair extent, you know, it wasn't just the alcohol brought me down in the end, which it definitely did. By the time I stopped drinking, I don't even know who I was. I don't feel like I had a soul. I didn't feel like there was a person in there. I was like a numb zombie kid. But what alcohol did for me before that was just ridiculous. Like, no one should love anything as much as I love drinking. I would look forward to Thursday nights like God was coming to campus. Like, it was all gonna be amazing. And I can totally remember it. You know, I was social share. I would get a big basket in college, and being social share, you put the alcohol in the basket and drove it home. I don't know if I could drive, but it's something. So really, it was a good time for years. So early drinking was just blackouts, high school and college. It was blackout drinking, and what I would tell myself is, well, I'm a blackout drinker because I don't get to drink very often. So I would tell myself a lot of things. I don't get to drink very often. I was sleeping. I was tired. I was hungry. I ate whatever it was, and that's why I went to sleep after I drank. Really, I just practiced blacking out every single place I drank. It was just the normal end of the night. In case you're wondering and you don't know that yet, it's not a normal end of the night. You don't have to black out when you drink. So that was my high school and college drinking. So what happened? Things got much worse. I could only drink so much when I was in high school and college, and then a couple of things accelerated my drinking. Number one was I turned 21 and I moved to New York. I had a job. That was the main accelerant. Like, I had freedom to drink. So really the only thing that had happened was the restraints were off. So then I could go out every single night, which I did. Just loved it. I loved that I was in the grown-up world and grown-ups were allowed to drink every night. I do remember, you know, it talks in the book about the moment of Bill feeling he had arrived. And I remember being in New York, being, you know, half drunk, walking across Central Park, and just happenstance coming across, you know, a couple thousand other people who were drinking and watching the opera outdoors, and everyone had booze. And that was like heaven. I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. Everyone drinks here. I died and went to, like, drinking heaven. But I really just felt that sense of, like, ease and comfort in a whole new level. So that went on. I had that. So then what happened? So it's a progression. So I'm drinking every single night, which isn't good for, like, a 25-year-old person to do. And my life is becoming unmanageable, but I'm barely holding on to the things that make it seem manageable. You know, I call my mother so I can ask for money for my rent. So that's manageable because I'm getting the rent paid. I'm going to work. I am crying under my desk a lot, so kind of just having, like, mental breakdowns, which at 25, I didn't have a really stressful job. You know, it probably wasn't such a big deal. I didn't need to cry under my desk, but I was doing that a lot. I don't think I did anything at work, actually. I just went, so I could go out after. So I'm breaking down. Now, there's some other serious stuff going on. So by serious stuff, I mean, like, I want to die every day, you know? And not in a, gonna kill my, I can't take it anymore. I don't know how other people exist. I remember Sunday afternoons watching people come home with groceries. So Sunday afternoon, you're getting ready for the work week, you're doing what needs to be done, and I would see them walking, and they would have groceries, and I would be like, how do you do that? Because I had to decide whether or not I was going to drink that night, if I hadn't already started. So of course, you know, when someone asks me to speak at Beacon, this is my home group, and I love this group, and I love everyone in this room, and I really do think about, like, well, what's different? What's, you know, how is my life different today? So first, every single part of my life is in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it's not always in Alcoholics Anonymous well, like sometimes I'm failing, but there isn't a part of my life today that I don't know is in AA, even if I mess it up. And then the other part is, I am 100% an alcoholic. I think for the very first years, I spent a lot of mental energy thinking about it. Am I an alcoholic? Am I not an alcoholic? Why? Is it because I have one dead brother and one dead dad? Or is it because of therapy? Or, like, what's the reason? Why? Is it genetic? Do I have to stop drinking? How long do I have to stop drinking for? Forever? What if I get married? What will I do? I cannot drink at my wedding. So that's like a couple of years of early sobriety. So even when I have a sponsor, even when I'm going to meetings, and even when I'm in the steps, I still had, like, this, you know, cloud over here, like, what if you're not really an alcoholic? What are you going to do if you wasted all these years not drinking? Because, it was serious. Like, I would have missed a lot of things because of my lack of drinking. And I didn't. I didn't miss much. I was able to participate in life full on. So that is one big thing that's different. I'm not just saying this, like, I am more in touch with my alcoholism and my first step today than I have ever been in my whole life. In fact, even just today, unfortunately. Okay, so we're hitting almost halfway here. So, I want to die, I go to my friends' weddings, I end up in the pool with my friends' dads, you know, I'm not doing well. And that was the funny part. Like, you know, I'll get a cab home, and then I'll throw up in the cab, And then I'll leave my wallet in the cab, and then the cab driver will ask me out when he finds my wallet, and then he'll be my boyfriend, and then that's my boyfriend. And, no, this is a true story. And then, he wants to take me home to meet his parents, but I want to bring my own bottle of wine. And they don't drink. Like, they're a religion that doesn't drink at all, ever. And he's like, no, you can't bring your own bottle of wine. I'm like, well, this is over. Plus drink, you know. I'm up in your cab. And that's the funny side. I mean, it was getting dark on the inside, though. So for the last year of my drinking, what I remember is knowing I was an alcoholic, knowing I couldn't stop, and knowing I was probably going to drink that night, which is what we call alcoholic torture. I have some pages here. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, that's my favorite phrase, or outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. So I was in full flight from reality. I had a dad who drank and died from drinking. My dad died because he had hip surgery, and in the 80s, he didn't tell the doctors how much he drank. So he probably died of some form of withdrawal after the surgery, maybe. And I had a brother who was sober in the program, a half-brother sober. I had an uncle who lives in Boston. He'd been sober like 30 years. So I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that if you couldn't stop drinking, you ended up there, so stop drinking. Like, control it, you know. Keep it under wraps. So, you know, I had this one really good friend who I saw recently. I've known her most of my life. And she did this thing. She took me to Central Park, and we got on the seesaw. And then she stayed on the bottom, and I was on the top of the seesaw, you know. And she's like, we got to talk about your drinking. And I was like, oh, God, do we? And she kept me on the top on the seesaw while she told me all the things that I had done recently, like the stomach pumping, the hospital, when my friends left me there. And what she said that really stung was, you always drink too much. And that hurt, because I could handle that I drank sometimes too much and sometimes not enough, but really always, I always drink too much. That's just so extreme, Kristen. And, you know, and she is my good friend today. We live through much together. Okay, so basically, I knew what to do. I found a meeting. I found a meeting first when I was back here living in Boston for the summer. I went to Looney Nooties. That was my first meeting. The guys at that meeting sat with me after the meeting, offered to pour out all my booze right there at Avant Pen. I declined their offer. I went back. I drank a few more times after that. I kind of think I had a little bit of like the DTs or something going on there. I remember seeing things a little bit, but that was the 90s, and a girl like me, no one was suggesting I go to detox or rehab, like, because I wasn't, you know, actually letting anyone know what was going on. I should have probably had some kind of treatment, but it's okay, I lived, lost a few brain cells maybe there, but so I start going to meetings in Boston. It doesn't quite catch because I always have a reason to go back to drinking. And then I start going to more meetings when I go back to New York, and I just get hooked in. I just go to enough meetings. I hold on to the seat. I don't talk. I don't make friends, but I hear the people. Like, I'm not talking to any of you, but I am definitely listening because I'm dying. And I get a sponsor because they kept on saying go to the sponsorship table, and I got one at the sponsorship table. She was a tall redhead named Amanda. I am very lucky that New York had tons of great meetings, and she was active in the program. She was looking to sponsor someone, and she was looking to take them through the steps in the Big Book. And that's what she did. So I benefited greatly from having that early experience in sobriety. Thank God, because what I did after that was like not the best behavior. But so thank God for Amanda. I remember her calling her every single day, crying. I still remember her cell phone number, 2128754. That was back in the first cell phone days. And so, you know, I get 2 years, I'm happy, I'm a GSR. I don't know what a GSR is, but I am one. And I did read the service manual, and that's a sign of insanity. If you have 2 years and you've read the whole service manual, You know, that's a thing. So I've read the service manual, and I have a boyfriend, and he's gay, and that's okay. We're just not talking about it. No, it's totally fine because I wasn't actually ready to have a boyfriend, and that was the problem. So one night, I open his medicine cabinet, and I have almost no drug experience. I smoked marijuana in 1984, one time. But my boyfriend, Art, who's sober in a day, has a medicine cabinet, so I take a bottle out, it says Valium on it, and then it says his name, okay? So there's the bottle, and then I put one in my mouth, and I put one in my purse for later. So it's kind of like when I was 14, like I didn't plan this, I don't have a game plan on how to either take drugs, steal them, or hide them, but I did it that night. So I knew, I was like, I don't remember. It was a strange mental blank spot as described in the book. Completely blank. Okay, 10 minutes left. Now that, people are like, oh, that's too bad. No, it was the best thing that ever happened, because prior to that, I had one set of rules for me and one set of rules for everyone else. I wasn't really believing that I was an alcoholic. I had almost zero humility. I struggle with that today as well, but let's just say that my sponsor said, you either get a new day count or I'm not sponsoring you anymore, and you're counting days, this time out loud for real, starting with one tonight. So I didn't have a choice, and I was fighting her on it. I was like, I can't believe that I fought her on that. I must have been out of my mind. So I try to remember that so that when I'm discussing something with someone who doesn't see it my way, I'm like, remember, Maria, you were so delusional. You believe that taking someone else's mood-altering substances did not alter your sobriety. So I've been there. So then I get sober again. So I know about that. I know about untreated alcoholism because I've had it for years at a time. I had it when I moved to California and I went to one meeting a week. It was a big book meeting, but I wasn't sponsored. I wasn't sponsoring, and I wasn't really sponsorable. I knew I was an alcoholic, though, and I will say if anything has kept me sober, other than, you know, sponsorship, God, staff, yada, yada, it is somehow deep in my core, I got it, I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink. I can suffer, I can mess things up, I can feel horrible or great, but I can't drink. So during these years, you know, I'm doing every single thing, and there's no known treatment except for ECT that I have not had to fix how I felt. And that was without drugs and alcohol on board. So I'm looking really hard, and I'm away from AA. I'm away from the traditions, which were so beautiful. My favorite part of this meeting every night is when we read the traditions. I'm away from the steps. I have no principles in any of my affairs. Things are getting worse and worse and worse. And I'm looking for solutions that aren't in this room. I was really dying, actually. So fast forward, you know, there's plenty of great times and plenty of bad times, but let's just cut to the quick. I'm working in 2-week stints on an Indian reservation, you know, in South Dakota, and I'm rescuing dogs, and I'm out of my mind in South Dakota. And then while I'm not in South Dakota, I'm living in my mom's house, which is always a good idea when you're over 30. And I'm back in Cape Cod, and I know that this one girl had moved back to Boston from New York, and I remembered her. I'm like, I know she started the meeting. So I would literally call Central Services, and I'd be like, hey, so there's this tall redhead, and she moved, and she started the meeting, and they'd be like, well, why don't we go to Doug? No. So, because I knew, somewhere inside of me, I knew what the problem was. I just wasn't going to admit it. And I remember I had gone to meetings on Cape Cod, and I met with this woman in AA. You know, I'm 15 years sober, and I sit down with her at Starbucks, and I tell her my litany of woes, like work, jobs, relationships, money, yada, 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 yada. I give her all my problems, because I trust her, because I've heard her speak in a meeting. And I'm like, so what do you think is wrong? And she says, I think you have untreated alcoholism. And I was aghast. I was like, are you serious? That's it? And it was. That was it. End of the story. And I was like offended too, you know. It's not that simple. You don't understand. You know, this happens. And it was. So I'm calling my current sponsor. I'm calling her from my mother's shed at 10 o'clock at night. And I'm telling her everything's okay. And that I'm not going to drink, even though I'm thinking about some really dark stuff. And she says, how long do you think you can feel this bad before you drink again? And I had no answer. And I asked her what to do, and she suggested that I join Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, okay. Because I knew what she meant. She didn't have to really go into detail, I knew it. So I really rejoined AA with some heavy-duty untreated alcoholism on board. I only have 6 minutes left, thank goodness, but then I'm sure I forgot almost everything I wanted to say, which is okay. Yes, I got a still. Okay, so this is my brother's big book, my half-brother. He died of the DTs this spring, so that's one brother. And it has his outlines and underlines and everything, and I love it. And he's here with me, so I bring him. So here's the thing. This brother dies. I have another half-brother. And when this brother dies, I pick a huge fight with my last remaining brother, because I have another one who died, but we won't talk about him tonight. So I have two half-brothers left from one of my dad's previous marriages, and one dies, and then I have one left. So what do? I pick a horrible fight. Like, I call him, and I tell him every single thing that's wrong with him and why, and then I make it even better, and this is sober, obviously. Then I call his wife, and I tell her everything that's wrong with her husband and why. Don't do that. It's really hard to correct. And then, as soon as I did it, like not long after, I literally call my sponsor, and I tell her what I did, and I say, and I'm not making amends. Like, that was what I said, and I meant it. I was like, not this time. He's too big a jerk. So what I did was I basically made it so I had almost no family left. So I was down to me and my mom. So I completely destroy, you know, the only sibling I've got left. So because of strong sponsorship, I mean, seriously, if I didn't have a sponsor with a backbone to tell me sometimes what was going to happen, I probably wouldn't be speaking to Toby today, but instead of having a zero relationship with Toby, I wrote it out. I saw where I was wrong, which was only in like 1,000 places. And I was able, most importantly, to give up the kernel that justified what I did, because the reason this brother is dead is because he couldn't give up the kernel that justified everything, how he felt, what he thought, how he acted, how he drank, and how he took drugs. So there's this tight kernel of alcoholism, and that is why he's dead. I have the same tight, unmovable, very unattractive kernel of alcoholism. And I was able to call my brother and not just apologize, like, I'm sorry it happened, but really, like, see it from his point of view. You know, even if I don't agree with him, see why he did what he did, because after someone dies, things are very tense. It's a tight, scary time. So I get to talk to Toby on the phone, and I say, can I still come to Wisconsin? So, and he says yes, because he and his wife just bought a retirement home in Wisconsin, and it is in a beautiful town. It's like Portlandia in Wisconsin. It's all co-ops, and everyone grows their own lettuce, and everyone's super nice. And I spent 4 days there, like 2 weekends ago or something. And I went to their version of Whole Foods, and I bought this like little glitter that goes on your eyelids. So that's how I'm bringing the man who's up onto the stage with me tonight. So I just had the best time with my brother and his wife. And I didn't grow up with this guy, but we're alike. Like, we act like brother and sister at the table, even though I don't have a childhood shared with him. And he and his wife, like, they love me. No matter what happens, if I mess up at work, if I get fired, whatever I do, they love me. And without AA, I would not be in their life at all. They made up the guest room for me. I mean, they really brought me home. And now I'm thinking I might land is cheap, so I might try to buy a teeny tiny piece of land across the street from Toby's house. And it's important because I have nieces and nephews, this brother's son, kids, And they hate Toby. And I have to make sure that I don't feed that, that I don't feed the family dysfunction, that I try to bring them to Wisconsin, that I try to get them in the family. Just, we only have each other, and we are what we are, and nobody's perfect. I know when I was in my 20s, I wrote hate letters home for years, so I don't blame them. But I want them to have a family. They're not in AA, but what AA will let me do is, if I can be in Toby's life, then they can be in Toby's life. And we are all we have left, so that's what we need to do. I'm sure that I forgot a lot that I need to say, but usually when I'm done, I'm sensing that I'm done, so I'm done.
Thank you, Maria. Now we have Nick and Katie for festivities. Woo!
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. This group has another meeting Monday nights, 8 p.m. It's called Beacon by the Book, right up the road, School of Psychoanalysis, 1581 Beacon Street in Brookline. Everyone is welcome to attend that meeting. And we also do fellowship after this meeting. So right here at the corner of Beacon and Harvard, Lee's Burgers, right after the meeting. Tons of people go every week. Please come join us. Several announcements. We'll power through them. NECIPA 28 is happening in Portland, Maine, New Year's weekend. I think it's December 29th through the 31st. There'll be more info over on the board for that one, along with all these other announcements. The 54th Annual Massachusetts State AA Convention is happening November 10th through the 12th in Framingham, Sheridan Hotel. And District 14 is putting on an AA history workshop. It's going to happen right here, meeting the second Thursday of each month at 7 p.m. You can see Corey for more info on that.
Hi. So the Boston bid for ICIPA, which is the International Conference of Young People in AA, is holding their second round of elections. That's going to be October 15th at 5 p.m. at Central Services. So it's a really great way to get involved with young people in AA and just hold a position and meet some folks. So that's all we got for you. Thank you. And if you guys have any announcements from your Nick to make, just please let us know and we'll make those. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lee. Festivity commitment booking for this group. This month's commitment is going to be on Friday, October 20th. We're going to Homeward Bound. We went there, I think it was June, and they loved having us, so they invited us back. Homeward Bound is a meeting that meets on Fridays from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. at Boston Central Service. That's 12 Channel Street. All are welcome. We have, I think, Victoria is the person I spoke to already to be the driver chair. Maybe not. I spoke to, it was, okay. So we have one person. I need either a driver or a chair. So if you'd like to, she can do either. So if you'd like to do one of those, please come see me tonight. We need to get that taken care of now. And the pickup for that, you don't need to have a car, will be at Dunkin' Donuts Cleveland Circle at 4:45 p.m. So you can see me, or what are you asking? Friday, October 20th. This is Victoria. She'll stand up. You can see her if you'd like to come on that commitment. All are welcome. And you can also see me. And like I said, I need a driver or a chair. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Anna, an alcoholic. I'm this group's GSR, so Maria previewed me. I'm the General Service Representative, so basically I'm this group's link to General Service of AA as a whole. We had our district meeting tonight. It's every first Thursday of the month at 6:30 at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, if anyone wants to come. But just a couple of announcements. I know it seems far away, but if you're interested in getting involved in a planning committee for an alpathon, which is basically meetings every hour for like 24 hours, we do them a lot of times on holidays. And so the one on Christmas is being co-hosted by districts 12 and 13, and then our district, which is 14. And so if you want to get involved in planning that, the meeting is October 10th at 7 p.m. at Albanpan on Boylston Street. And the other thing is if you like money and you want to be involved in the district's money, you should come see me because we're looking for an alternate treasurer and we could really, really use help in all seriousness. So if you're looking for a way to be a service and you can show up on the first Thursday of every month at 6:30 and you like money, you should see me about it. Thank you.
For CHIPS, we have Jason and Katie.
I am Teddy, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict. Here at the Beacon Group, we give all the CHIPS to mark anniversary, milestones, and recovery. If you hear your time, please come up and get your CHIP. First CHIP is for 18 months. Yeah! 11 months.
Christina, after the meeting.
This has been a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're cordially invited to meet with us again next Thursday and to become a regular member of our group. If you have any questions regarding the meeting group or Alcoholics Anonymous, please see any of our members after the meeting. Will all group members please raise your hands? Please remember our custom of thanking the speakers. The line will form to my right. And now for all who care to join, the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,